Let's go. So I want to start this by sharing something, I guess, a bit more on the personal end. This drasha is about mindfulness and mitzvos in our own lives. And I thought I should begin by sharing that, you know, if anything, I was thinking about whether I should maybe have saved this for a year or two to see where this goes, or whether this is shayach for right now. But I decided it could be powerful that I see myself on the seeker end of mindfulness, and what I'm sharing with you tonight is really just some preliminary thoughts, some of which I've thought about from the halachic end, but in terms of my own personal experiences, the jury's still going to be out to see what this is doing for my own life. About a couple months ago, the RCA has sent out an email advertising an online therapy service called listening.com. It's listning.com. And what it is, it's not face-to-face therapy, but it's text therapy, where you go online and you communicate with someone, and they help you out. And I was intrigued. It's very economical and very time-savvy, because you don't have to go out, you don't have to, you know, spend time getting to an office and coming back and the hour there, but it's really from the convenience of your own computer at any time. So I was intrigued, and I looked, and I saw that there was a therapist, Guy Wismicha, who's a therapist, who focuses on mindfulness. And I was thinking that this is something that I've wanted to think about for a long time, truth be told. I've heard a lot about mindfulness, and the concept of it sounded like something that could be very uplifting, something very empowering. So I've decided to try it out. And as I said, the jury is still out there to see what's going to come with it. Worked on a little bit of meditation and the like. But, you know, when it comes to therapy, so therapy sometimes is for people who need a lot of psychological help. But the truth is, we all have things that we can work on. We have mitos to work on. We have things in our lives that, even if our lives are good, the quality of our life can still go upwards. And it was with that kavana that I decided to embark on this. And so as I'm sharing my ideas on mindfulness, I'm sharing this as also somebody who's not an expert in this, but somebody who is really on the seeking end. And I hope that maybe other people will become interested in these ideas as well. Think about what it means to be mindful versus what it means to be mindless. Think of a couple of scenarios. So sometime, you know, not too long ago, I remember that Eliana and I were out driving. We came back, we parked, wasn't so close to our apartment. We walked back, I got to the doors, and I realized that I left the keys in the car. So that's an example of being a little bit mindless. If I was truly focused on what was happening, I would have thought about what's in the car, what do I need to bring in with me. So that's at the end of the day, it was a fairly harmless example. There are probably more harmful examples. Actually, the first time I went to my in-laws when I was starting to date Eliana, I was staying in a different house, and I locked myself. It was an hour before Shabbos. And I was going in and out of the car, and apparently the door, the front door was a self-locking door, so I locked myself out. So being locked out probably is a much more stressful experience, but just, you know, leaving your key somewhere where they're accessible isn't the worst in the world. And there's another level of not paying attention, which, you know, example of that might be in class. If you look in the modern college class, people have their laptops, people might have their cell phones, and some people are taking notes. I remember being surprised when I got to yeshiva after college and how many laptops there were, and most people were actually taking notes. A lot of people during college classes are not taking notes. And there, on the one hand, again, the effects of being mindless might not be so strong, but at the same time, you're really losing out, unless it's a class that you really couldn't care for. But here you are, you're paying the money, and you're taking the time to show up. And I've done this in my life as well. So again, I'm talking to myself in some ways. But at the end of the day, what was the point of going if the whole time we're sitting behind the screen doing other things. And then there's, like, another level, I guess, of being mindless, which is an example brought in a book called Meditation Is Not What You Think. It's by Dr. John Kabat-Zinn, who's one of the modern gurus of mindfulness. So in his introduction, he shares an example. Let's just say you started having back pains or neck pains. So you notice it maybe, but you don't really pay attention to it, and it sits and festers. And think about what can happen all that time that you're not paying attention to it until it's too late. And we think of all these different levels of what it means to not be paying attention, not to being mindless. So on the one hand, at the best, maybe an inconvenience might result from being mindless. But at the worst, when we think about the real effects of not paying attention, we can really lose a lot in life. So with that, let's go into, I'm sharing these macros on the screen. Hopefully you can still see me a little bit. Let's see what mindfulness is. What is mindfulness and why is it important? So Dr. Kabat-Zinn, at the very beginning of his book, he writes that mindfulness is synonymous with awareness. And I think that's one thing, especially as we go through the sugya, a mitzvah tichel kavana, whether mitzvah require kavana, that's actually a very foundational definition to think about. Mindfulness is synonymous with awareness. My operational definition of mindfulness is that it is the awareness that arises from paying attention on purpose in the present moment and non-judgmentally. If you need reason for doing so, we could add in the service of wisdom, self-understanding, and recognizing our intrinsic interconnectedness with others, with the world, and thus also in the service of kindness and compassion. It's for ourselves, it's for the world, and I will add in for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And he further adds that mindfulness can be cultivated, developed, and refined carefully and systematically as a practice, as a way of being through mindfulness and meditation. It boils down to simply paying attention in your life as if it really, really matters. Because it does more than you think. I've been told by my assistant to zoom in on the Makoros a little bit, so I'll make it a little bigger. I hope that's helpful. Now I just need to move this over. In fact, minimize this. I'll stop at certain points to take questions because I'm not going to be able to see right now, but I'll stop at certain points to take questions. Okay, so it boils down to simply paying attention in your life as if it really, really mattered because it does and more than you think. And I think that alone, I think, convinces me the importance of mindfulness. Because who wants to walk through life and realize that we just, it happened to us, but we weren't aware of it, that we weren't active in it? The importance of being mindful is that it actually really does matter. Think about how mindfulness works. So I liked this analogy that came from a writer in the Washington Post. I believe she's a teacher. She said that mindfulness is about more than calming down, right? So meditation is not just about sitting and humming and about calming down, but it's much more profound than that. She said many people think that practicing mindfulness means clearing your mind, but it's actually the very opposite. More about metacognition, or thinking about thinking, as my elementary school students have been learning lately. That it's thinking about thinking. So the point is that it's not to create a void in our minds, but that we're thinking about what we're thinking, we're thinking about what we're doing. It's as if we talk about how our minds are always flitting around finding new things to think about. It's as if there's a remote control device in our brains that changes the channels randomly. We choose a channel, but our minds might change the channel to something else. We might not even notice it. We might plan to watch the math homework channel and then realize a few minutes later that we spent the last 5 minutes on our narwhal's real channel. This happens to everyone. To get better at noticing what is happening in our minds and get more intentional about what we want to be thinking about, we practice something called remote control breathing. We sit with our eyes closed or looking down. We take 3 deep breaths. We let our breath settle into our normal rhythm and try to count our breaths. She says, but here's the magic. Each time we notice that our mind has changed the channel, we're having a moment of metacognition. We notice what our mind's doing, and then we can make a choice. Do we want to keep watching the What's for Lunch channel, or do we want to go back to the breathing channel? Having the ability to notice what your mind is doing and make a choice about what you want is very liberating and powerful. Mindfulness is about being in control of our lives. Again, not letting our lives happen to us, but being active in it. And I'm going to want to come back to this remote control. I like this analogy. To what extent can we control what channel we are as we go through our lives for ourselves, in our relationships, in our relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu? Dr. Kabat-Zinn further notes, if we examine this phenomenon of not paying attention by simply observing our interior, exterior lives from time to time, it soon becomes quite apparent just how much time we are out of touch. We are out of touch with our feelings and perceptions, with our impulses and our emotions, with our thoughts, with what we are saying, and even with our bodies. This is mostly due to being perpetually preoccupied, lost in our minds, absorbed in our thoughts, obsessed with the past or the future, consumed with our plans and desires, diverted by our needs to be entertained, driven by our expectations, fear, or cravings of the moment, however unconscious and habitual all this might be. Point is, we're out of touch, and all these reasons are true. We're out of touch because of all the things that are bothering us, by what we think about the past, thinking about the future, because we're bored. And our out of touch is not limited to not seeing things that are right in front of us, or not hearing what is clear coming to our ears, or missing out on the world of fragrance and taste and touch because we're so preoccupied and distracted. How many times have you unwittingly and improbably walked into the door you were opening, or inadvertently banged your head or elbow on something, or dropped something you didn't know you were carrying, because in that moment you weren't actually there? So we were momentarily out of touch even within the spatial and temporal orientation of the body, which normally we have covered without too much specific attention. So on the one hand, being mindful means that we're aware, that we're in control, that we're able to switch our channels, to be able to choose the channel where we need to be right now. And not being mindful is being out of touch with what's going on, because there are many legitimate things that may be on our minds, but we see the results as we forget the keys in the car, we totally missed the class, we totally weren't there, we walked into the door, etc., etc. But the truth is, as much as this has been promoted by people like Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn and by elementary school teachers throughout the country, mindfulness is a very Jewish idea. Pasuk Devarim says, "Ushmartem es divrei habris hazos vasisem osam leman taskilos kol asher tasun." Should guard the words of this covenant and do them in order. Taskilu et kol asher tasun. Now, taskilu would seem to be to understand. But I heard from Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg, he pointed out the Targum Yerushalmi on this pasuk that says, "Biklau tisbonenun yas kol mad dimis avdin." That the reason why we need to do mitzvos is so that we are present in the world. Doing mitzvos gives us presence in the world, that we're able to contemplate, that we're able to truly, when we're going through life, that we're mindful of what's happening in every moment of our lives. And these ideas recently have been very much promoted by Dr. Benjamin Epstein in this book called Living in the Presence. I don't know if you can see this on top of the screen, but he writes that there's only one way that person can truly attain this. So back up for a second. He talks about how his version of Judaism for much of life was, I want to chop mitzvahs, I want to get schar, and if I do this and then good things happen, it may be in the next world. But then he realized that really the benefits are not just in Olam Haba, but really in this world. That there's bliss that we can have in this world. The present is God's gift to us. He says many spiritual traditions attribute greater or lesser value to living in the present. The Jewish tradition is extraordinary in conjoining the divine and the mundane, believing at its very core that the present moment holds the key to connecting to the divine. In Jewish tradition, God is always both transcendent and immanent, filling every iota of physical existence. And Dr. Epstein explains that psychological research has shown tremendous benefits from mindfulness. There are medical benefits. We can alleviate pain through mindfulness. We can drive off depression and anxiety. The research is overwhelming that mindfulness is very, very important to our health. And yet, Yet, it's more than that. While these current goals of mindfulness on alleviating stress and pain, this book aims higher, writes about his book, as befits a book that purports to capture central Judaism and strives to transform the totality of how a person relates to his daily existence. This book has an admittedly grand and modest goal. It aims to alter your mind and change the way you live your life. So, for some people, mindfulness might be a hankatinsa, might be a path to certain benefits to help our life become better. Dr. Epstein's point is that Judaism, the Torah, and mitzvos, when we do them in the present, when we're living them in the present, transform the very essence of our lives, not just certain aspects of our lives. And a concept that perhaps encapsulates this idea is the concept of Yishuv Hadas. Yishuv Hadas, Dr. Epstein says, becomes not only a description of a state of mind, but the means to cultivate a state of being. The key to being fully alive and at peace is to be settled in and connected to whatever is happening in one's life, both internally and externally. Peace of mind can only come from a settled mind that is attached to and knows not merely cerebrally, but viscerally what is happening in here and now. And again, the psychological research is overwhelming. Importance of mindfulness in order to be healthy. But he says that Judaism takes this one step forward. Aside from the negative physical and psychological effects of not living in the present, as important as those results are, our thesis is that we have a fundamental spiritual need to cultivate and develop Yishuv Hadas to achieve unity within the present moment and with present conditions. Even if a person drifts only slightly away from his present reality, he ultimately suffers as severely as a person completely fixated on his past or future. Put simply, they both are not where they are supposed to be. In other words, Yishuv Hadas is not just, again, a way of relieving physical and psychological effects, but if we want to be connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then Yishuv Hadas, living in the present, is something that's extremely important. So now, before I go on, are there any questions? Okay. So now let's go on and let's see how this relates to Pesach. The Mishnah tells us, "Emsachim heviu lefanav mitabel bechazeres ach megiel parparas papas." So the Mishnah says that we're supposed to have karpas. They bring the karpas. The formulation of the Mishnah is actually very strange, because there are a lot of concepts missing here. But Rashbam explains that heviu lefanav hayirakot achar shibirech al hayayin. So after our kaddish, we have the karpas. We have the vegetables. Karpas is actually not mentioned in the Talmud, but we're supposed to have the vegetables. And if one doesn't have karpas, as Rashi explains, at that point, you can dip the lettuce, you can dip the chazeres in the charosis, and that's what you have as part of your karpas. So that's what the Mishnah says. You're supposed to have a vegetable, and if you don't have another vegetable besides the maror, then you have the maror both at the beginning, at the karpas, and then also later again. So the Gemara delves straight into this and says, "Nimi Rav Shlakish, Zot Omeret Mitzvos Tzrichos Kavana." From the fact that I have to have maror twice must mean that mitzvos require that I have intention while I'm doing them. I must be actively thinking about it while I do it. Kevan de lo be'idam chiyuva de maror hu da'achile, since I'm not eating maror, when I'm having the karpas, it's not the time for maror, I'm eating it only type of bur priyadama as part of the beginning of the Seder, but maybe when I have, if I have the maror for the karpas also, because I don't have another vegetable, and it's not the time of maror yet, so maybe I'm not thinking about the obligation of maror. I'm just thinking that it's part of my karpas. I'm at that stage of the Seder, not the maror. So since I'm not thinking about the maror, therefore I have to make dip and have maror again. So this teaches us that mitzvahs require kavana. In order to be yotze in the mitzvah maror, I have to have in mind that I'm having the maror for the purpose of the mitzvah, and if I don't, have to dip it again. And we're assuming here that most people who are having Maror or Karpas, if they're in that situation, are not thinking about Maror, and therefore you have to dip twice. Now, the Gemara continues by saying, how do I know that mitzvahs require kavana? Maybe I don't need kavana in order to do a mitzvah. And why do I need to dip twice then? Perhaps it's because I need to create a heker for the tinokos. A lot of the things we do on the Seder night are in order to arouse the children to ask questions. So if that's the case, then maybe the reason why I dip twice is simply in order to preserve that I want the children to ask. It has nothing to do with whether mitzvos require kavana or not. So that's what the Gemara suggests here. And the reason why v'chitema im kein lishmeina shar yirakos yesh meina shar yirakos hava mina hecha de'ika shar yirakos u'dina trei tibuli. You might have thought, the reason why it mentions that specifically I have to dip maror twice is I might have thought that maybe if I have the maror, okay, so then I don't have to dip twice. It's only if I have other vegetables I should dip twice. So according to this line of thinking, even if I have chazaret, I still need to dip twice in order to create a heker for the tinokos. So we see here a machlokas in the Gemara about whether or not mitzvos require intention, whether I have to have in mind in the present moment that I'm trying to do a mitzvah. Okay, and this is going to remain a matter of tension throughout all the different Gemaras and poskim that we're going to see. The Gemara continues with a beraita that if you eat maror that was demai, that might not have been tithed properly, achlam below miskaven yatsa. And if I eat the maror without having kavana, without having intention, I am yotze. So this would seem to say, again, that mitzvahs don't require kavana. And the Gemara derives from here that perhaps this is a machlokas between the Tanaim. Because Rabbi Yossi says, even though I did the chazaris, it's a mitzvah to have it again at the time of Maror. So according to Rabbi Yossi, again, it might seem like that mitzvahs require kavana, so therefore I have to have it twice. But according to other individuals, maybe mitzvahs don't require kavana, and the only reason why I'm dipping Maror twice is in order to create recognition for the children. The Gemara continues further that pshita, it's obvious that if there are other vegetables, that I should have the other vegetables and then eat it, and then I have Maror later. But what if I only have lettuce? So Rav Huna says, well, then you make Borei Priya Adama on the first Maror, and then on the second Maror, when it comes time for the mitzvah of Maror, like it's done in the Haggadah, then I make the Bracha Avachios Maror. And then Rav Chisda goes wild on him. He says, "La'achar shemile kreso heimenu chozem varach aleha." Once I've already consumed the maror, I've tasted it. Undoubtedly, I've experienced the maror. So how can I go back and make a bracha, a asher kishem satav tzivanu alachias maror, if I already had it earlier that night? So according to Rav Chisda, if I'm going to have maror during the karpas, I have to make the bracha alachias maror at the first karpas. Because otherwise, I've already tasted it. There's no escaping that in that moment, I experienced the maror. And the Gemara concludes that at the end of the day, in order to remove one from doubt, in order to not take sides, one should try to make sure that they have a different vegetable besides maror for the karpas. But we see here a tension between whether I can even use the maror as karpas. We seem that we do, but then the question becomes, well, what happens when I'm supposed to have the maror later? Do I make the bracha on it? Was I already yotze during karpas for maror? So that gives us the machlokas of whether mitzvahs require kavana, whether I had that maror the first time, even if I explicitly wasn't thinking about the maror, can I avoid the fact that I ate the maror? Can I avoid the fact that I had that experience? And do I need intention or to fulfill that mitzvah? So that's what it comes up with maror. And we actually have a similar idea that comes up with matzah and the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, of all places. So the Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah tells us that if somebody was passing behind a shul, or they were in a house, their house near a shul, and they heard the sound of the shofar, or they heard the Megillah. So if they had kavana, then they're yotzei, and if not, they're not yotzei. Now, of course, from this Mishnah, it sounds like that mitzvahs do require kavana. It says explicitly, if I had intention to hear the shofar, I fulfilled my obligation. If not, not. Same thing with Megillah. So that's what the Mishnah... And afal pi shezeh shama vezeh shama could be that one person was listening, another person was listening, and the outcome might be entirely different from them. Because if one person had intention and one person, another person didn't, then they haven't done their job. Then they haven't fulfilled their intention. They haven't fulfilled their obligation. So the Gemara continues in Rosh Hashanah with the example actually of matzah. Question is, let's say somebody was forced to eat matzah, which maybe is plausible, maybe for lots of people who really don't love matzah so much, so maybe there's a scenario where it's possible someone would be forced matzah. But if someone was forced to eat matzah, then they fulfilled the obligation. So Gemara asks, who forced them to eat the matzah? If it was a demon, well, then that person is halakhically considered a shota, considered to be insane. And therefore, doesn't matter if they're not obligated in the first place. So, Rav Ashi explains that the scenario is that, let's say, I don't know why Persians are brought in here, but let's say that he was in captivity, and the captives, foreign captives, forced him to eat matzah. Was he yotzei? So the Gemara, in this case, is saying yes. And Rava concludes from this that same with shofar. That if I blow shofar in order, just because I like the sound of it, I want to create a musical environment with my shofar, I fulfilled my obligation. So Gemara says, obviously, right? If I'm yotzei, if I'm forced to eat matzah, I wasn't choosing to eat matzah, I didn't necessarily intend to eat matzah. So same thing, if I blow shofar in order to play music, even though I wasn't necessarily thinking about the mitzvah, so I should obviously be obligated. But the Gemara says, well, maybe I would think that matzah and shofar are different, because matzah, the Torah says I have to eat it, so I ate it. Same thing with maror. Once I've filled my belly, once I've had the experience of tasting it, so I've tasted it. Obviously, I fulfilled my obligation at that point. But here with shofar, it's actually different. Because shofar says zichron trua. It's supposed to have the memory of the trua, the memory of the blasts. So if I'm just blowing shofar for fun, maybe that's different. So Rava's coming to tell us that mitzvahs don't require kavanah, even if I'm blowing the shofar for fun, I'm still yotzei. And yet, we can see here something conceptually brewing. That experience of having matzah, something that I'm tasted, that is different than something where it's not just enough to do an action, but something that is much more internal. And that's something that we're going to have to explore and probe a little more. So the Gemara brings a couple of different examples and counterexamples. When it comes to Shema, the Mishnah Brachos says that if I was learning Torah and it happens to be time for Shema and I was reading Shema in the Torah, so if I had intention, then I'm yotzei. If not, then I'm not. But then the Gemara says, well, maybe, what does it mean to have, what was I having intention for? Was it not to reach Shema? So, but of course, if you only need to have intention to reach Shema, so you're reading it. So the Gemara answers, well, maybe if a person was reading the Torah scroll to check it and they weren't really paying attention to it, so that's where it matters whether it had kavana or not. But what we'll see here is that the from some of these examples and counter examples is that the definition of mitzvah tzrichos kavana can be very narrow. It could be that as long as I had some semblance of awareness of what I was doing, maybe I've fulfilled my obligation. It's only the most extreme examples of having absolutely no awareness of what was going on and what the purpose of it was that I'm not yotzei. But the Gemara continues when it comes to shofar. Skip down here. Gemara says, "Come in here. Niskaven shomea v'lo niskaven mashmia. Niskaven mashmia v'lo niskaven shomea lo yatsa. Achi iskaven shomea mashmia." In order to fulfill the obligation of shofar, both the blower and the listener have to have kavana. And that makes it sound like that both the mashmi and the shomei are on the same level. The blower and the listener are on the same level. Right? The shomei, the one listening, has to listen for himself to have to have in mind for himself, and the mashmia, the person blowing the shofar, also has to have it, is having it in mind for himself. And even so, it says lo yatsa. So that means that both of them need to have kavana in order for their obligation. So again, here, this is a machlokas tanan. This is a machlokas between the rabbis and the Mishnah, that, because in the Baraita it says, shomea, shomea la'atzmo, mashmia, mashmia lefi darko. That when a person's listening, we assume he's listening for his own purpose, and the one who is blowing the shofar is blowing for everybody. But Rabbi Yossi said that's only true if somebody's blowing shofar for the whole community. But if somebody's blowing shofar for an individual, they have not fulfilled their obligation unless both of them have intention to fulfill their obligation. Both the person blowing and the person listening to the shofar have to have in mind that both of them are being yotzei. So what we see so far, just to summarize what we've seen so far, is we have a machlokas about whether mitzvahs require kavana. Do I need to be aware? Do I need to be thinking about the purpose of what I'm doing, the mitzvah? Do I need to be thinking about that when I'm doing a mitzvah? And the truth is, the Gemara is not entirely clear. We're going to see very soon that in the Rishonim and Achronim, it remains a bit of a controversy. But something that we might be able to extract from here is that it seems like, first of all, that the level of kavana that we require to be yotzei is quite a low bar. But also, it's not even universally agreed upon that I need to have kavana, which is astounding to me. If think about shofar for a second. The purpose of shofar, as the Rambam says, is to be a wake-up call for us to do tshuva, and I'm totally not thinking about that. No wonder that I accomplished with shofar. And yet, it seems like that even for those who require kavana, I only need a slight awareness of what's going on in order to be yotzei, in order to fulfill my obligation. And many opinions in the Gemara and the Rishonim don't even require that at all. Now, Tosfot comes to conclusion that he said, they say, V'hashta kol elu amorai savar devai kavana ustamid misarder hashah savar hachi. Tosfot makes an exception that throughout the Gemara, there is an intrinsic assumption that mitzvahs require kavana, although again, this is not necessarily universally agreed upon. But then again, they make, I think, a very important distinction. When it comes to eating, when it comes to matzah, when it comes to maror, I don't need so much kavana because the experience of tasting it is enough for me to be aware to, you know, if I wasn't aware before, it's aroused my awareness of what's going on. When it comes to tefillah and tekiyah, when it comes to davening, when it comes to blowing the shofar, things that are dependent upon my heart, what I'm thinking about, maybe that's a little bit different. So first, before we go any further, I just want to see halacha lamaisa, what conclusion we come to. So the Aruch HaShulchan explains when it comes to maror, if I have lettuce, if I have maror as my karpas, then I should make the bracha bori alachilas maror on the first dipping, because the second dipping, how is it possible to make another bracha alachilas maror? I already fulfilled my obligation. I already ate it. I already experienced it. That I was far mile kreso. So therefore, I should make the bracha early on. And yet, the Aruch HaShulchan says that that since it's a matter of controversy, it's better to not eat maror as your karpas, you should eat something else. But again, there's a concern that perhaps I don't need to have kavana in order to be yotzei the mitzvah. So maybe I need to make the bracha before my first eating, even though at that time I'm not even having a mind to do the mitzvah. It's not my purpose. When it comes to matzah, the Shulchan Aruch says, if a person ate matzah without kavana, I had no intention, I fulfilled my obligation, assuming that I know that tonight is Pesach, and then I'm obligated to eat matzah. So if it's Pesach, let's just say that, you know, forget the examples of a non-Jew or a bandit forcing you to eat matzah, but let's just say I really hate matzah and I don't want to eat it, and somebody says it's Pesach, you have to eat matzah, I'm going to force you to eat it. So of course, at that point, a person knows it's Pesach, they know they're obligated to eat it, and at that point, they fulfill their obligation. But if the person thinks that it's a weekday, that what they're eating is in matzah, then they haven't fulfilled their obligation. So Shulchan Aruch here rules that I still need to have some level of understanding of what I'm doing. It's true that even if I didn't intend to perform the act myself, I wasn't the one who drove that action. If I have some awareness, it's good. But I can't be completely absent-minded. If I have absolutely no idea what's going on, that absolutely does not count. And the Torah explains that in general, this concept of mitzvos tzrichos kavana is subject to a very big controversy. Halachos Gedolos of Babylonia says that mitzvos do require kavana. The Reitz Gia says that the halachos like Rava, the mitzvos don't require kavana. And same with the Rabbeinu Hanano, Rav Shira Gaon. So we see here this actually, for a very long time, this remained a controversy. And the Torah relies on his father, the Rush, who says that mitzvos do require kavana. But I still find myself astounded that the stakes should be so high here. We should want, of course, if I'm doing a mitzvah, I should want to have intention to do it. I should want intention even to understand what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. And yet, unlike many other things in halacha, there was far from a consensus on this matter. And the Beis Yosef, authored by Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, so he ends up paskening that mitzvahs do require kavana because his three major poskim, the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rosh, require it. But when you look at the Shulchan Aruch itself, you look at the Shulchan Aruch, it says that according to some, mitzvos do require kavana, and there's some who say that mitzvos don't require kavana. Sorry. Some say that mitzvos don't require kavana, and some say that mitzvos have a requirement at least to fulfill your obligation while you're doing it. I should have in mind that I want to fulfill my obligation. V'chein halacha. And here, so he gives both sides, which is remarkable. He often just tells you what he thinks, but because this is a matter of such great controversy, the Shulchan Aruch gives both opinions, but he does tell you that he personally believes that mitzvahs do require kavana, but again, a very low level of kavana. That I have to just have kavana to fulfill the obligation. Not kavana that, you know, that I'm eating matzah, zecher, tias mitzrayim, and anything like that. I just have to kavana to do that mitzvah. Chai Adam says on this that when we say that mitzvos don't require kavana, it's only if a person's reading Shema b'derech limudok, or if a person eats matzah. When a person doesn't fulfill their obligation because they don't have kavana, that's only if they're reading Shema as they were learning it but didn't have the mitzvah in mind, or they were forced to eat matzah because they thought that it was. If that was a weekday. But if one reached Ma, Kederach She'anu Korin Keseder Tefillah, V'chenk She'ocha Matzah, Otaka, V'nata Lulav, Af Al Pishol Kivin Latzeis Yatza, She'arei Mishum Zeh Osa Kedei Latzeis Af Al Pishena Mechave. Chaya Adam comes and tells us that, yes, mitzvahs require kavana, but not such a high level of kavana. I have to be aware that what I'm doing is a mitzvah, and then I'm doing something related to the mitzvah. But as long as, if I'm saying Shema as I'm going through the Siddur, or I'm taking a lulav because it's Sukkis, so then, Af Al Pi Shelo Kivin, let's say, Yatzah, even though he didn't necessarily, he wasn't actively thinking about fulfilling his obligation, that's enough because he was doing it the way he normally does it. So again, this gets more and more astounding to me, that I can be going through davening, I could say Shema, and I could totally not be thinking of Shema. I could be eating matzah, I could be shaking lulav. I'm just going through the motions. And yet, if I've gone through the motions, I've done what I'm required to do. But otherwise, if I had absolutely no awareness, then that's no good. I have to be at least somewhat cognizant of it, but otherwise, no good. Before I go any further, any questions or comments? Any questions or comments up till now? Okay. Of course, you can unmute yourselves and interrupt me at any point. So, now that I've said when Kavana is technically required, I want to make an argument that really all mitzvahs require a higher level of Kavana. Someone asked, is this like davening? If you don't have Kavana, it's okay, but not ideal. So we're going to get to davening in a second. But I want to make an argument that, first of all, there's certain mitzvahs where it's not just enough to be aware that I'm doing it. You need to have a much higher level of understanding, of awareness, of appreciation for the mitzvah. And I'm going to further want to argue, even for the ones where it's enough to technically just have in mind that I'm doing the mitzvah for the sake of the mitzvah, then I still want to have more kavana than that. The Torah notes when it comes to Sukkot. Sukkot teshvu shivad yamim. I'm supposed to sit in the sukkah for 7 days. Leman yedu doretechem kiva sukkot oshavti b'nei Yisrael b'otzi otam. So the Torah quotes the pasuk that I had to sit in a sukkah for 7 days in order that my generations know that it was through Sukkot that I brought the Jewish people through the b'nei Yisrael through the desert. Tala akaso mitzvah sukkah b'tzias mitzrayim. And the mitzvah sukkah is tied with Yitzias Mitzrayim, that I have to have that in mind while I'm doing the mitzvah. And the Bayit Chadash, the Bach, notes here that's very fascinating, because often, now the Torah more than Shulchan Aruch does sort of explain the rationale behind the mitzvahs, but the Torah is not a commentator on Chumash, and it's not normal for the Torah to go through and to clarify what the pasuk is coming to teach us. It's just meant to give us a psak. It's not necessarily meant, the Torah is not necessarily trying to clarify what sort of kavanah I have to have and what the psukim mean. It's a book of halacha. And yet, he says, the reason why the Torah does this here is that since it says, l'man yidu, in order that you know, lo kiyam hamitzvah kitikuna im lo yad Yada kavanas mitzvah sasuka kfi pshata. If I do not understand the meaning behind the mitzvah of sukkah, I've not fulfilled my obligation, because the pasuk says in order to know. And if I don't understand, if I don't know why I'm sitting in the sukkah, then I haven't done the mitzvah according to the Bach. And same thing with tefillin. Tefillin, it has psukim that talk about the importance of remembering things related to Pesach, that tefillin is a sign that Hashem took us out of Egypt. If I don't have that in mind, I haven't fulfilled the obligation of tefillin. With tzitzis, it says, Lemantis geruv asetem kol mitzvotai v'tzem kdoshim lelokechem. If I'm not thinking about why I'm wearing tzitzis, then I've not fulfilled my obligation. With other mitzvahs, it could be that if I didn't have kavana, that, okay, so I did what was required, and even if I don't have kavana, I was yotze. But in these cases, with tefillin and tzitzis and sukkah, any mitzvah where the Torah gives us a reason why we do it, something for us to think about, something for us to remember, I did not fulfill the mitzvah if I did not have kavana. And that's something that's, I think, extremely important for us to have in mind. The Mishnah Berurah explains, we didn't really define this until now, but when the Gemara had this whole discussion about why the mitzvahs required kavana, what we essentially see is that there are really two different ways of understanding what kavana is. One way of kavana is that I have to have in mind that Hashem commanded me to do this and that I'm fulfilling my obligation. But another level of kavana is I have to have intention, I have to be actively aware of the mitzvah I'm doing and what it's about. And when it comes to, so let's look at Shema and Shemona Esrei. When it comes to Shema, v'chulei amachad chila mitzvah shichavim belibo, certainly, ideally, I should have kavana in my heart for what Shema is about. But yevet im lo kiven yatza, if I didn't have kavana, I'm yotzei, levami pasuk rishon shel kriyas Shema, ubirkos avos shel tefillah. the first paragraph of the Amidah and the first pasuk of Shema, I have not fulfilled my obligation if I didn't have this second level of kavanah, of really internalizing what the mitzvah is. But for other things, if I had kavanah to do the mitzvah, I'm yotze, even if I wasn't really being present while I was doing the mitzvah. But he says, and even when it comes to the idea of mitzvah tzrichos kavanah, the only controversy is whether I have to think about before I begin the mitzvah and that I want to fulfill the mitzvah. But u'mitzvah min ha-mufchar, the best way to fulfill a mitzvah, kulei alma modim de tzarich kavanah. I need both levels of kavanah, ideally, in order to fulfill the mitzvah. Ideally, I need both levels of kavanah. That's the best way to do the mitzvah. And Rashba says, especially when it comes to Shema, it comes to other things, so, you know, okay, so the stakes aren't high. I did the mitzvah, I did the action I was supposed to do, that's fine. But here with Shema, I need to have in mind what the matter is. And why is that? Because with Shema, the whole purpose of it is Kabbalat Ol Malchut Shemayim. This is what the Shulchan Aruch wants to get. I see that there's a hand up. I'll come back in a second. Shulchan Aruch says that, you know, there's some Rishonim who think that mitzvahs don't require kavanah. Fine. But a mitzvah tuya bedibur vaday tzarich kavana debelo kavana hava keino ose klum. So for mitzvahs that involve action, so let's say eating matzah, shaking the lulav, so it doesn't matter so much. But something that a mitzvah that's dependent upon my speech, so my speech has to be real speech. It can't just be my lips moving and happening. You know, it happens that I formulate the right words. But if I didn't have kavana when I'm saying those words, it means absolutely nothing. So when it comes to Shema, why do I need extra level kavana? Pasuk Shema Yisrael Shehu Ikar Kabbalas Ol Malchut Shemayim Tzarich Lasum Al Libo Dim Lo Kein Ein Zeh Kabbalas Malchut Shemayim Klal. The whole purpose of saying Shema is to accept upon myself the yoke of heaven. So it's very nice if I say the words, but if I haven't internalized what I'm doing, then I'm accepting Hashem's authority, that everything I do in my life is affected by what Hashem does. If I'm not thinking about that, the whole point of saying Shema is so that I remember this every single day. God doesn't just need us to recite the psukim and just to pay lip service to it, no pun intended. But if I'm not internalizing twice a day that Hashem is in charge of this world and that I accept that, then I have not then the mitzvah was pointless. I haven't done anything. It doesn't matter. And same thing with Shmona Esrei. The whole purpose of Shmona Esrei is not just so that God can hear us talk, but we're supposed to ask for mercy. And if I'm not doing that, the Shulchan Aruch says, I haven't done anything. In fact, the Rambam goes so far as to say, Kol tefila she'ena b'chavana, eina tefila. Any davening that does not have kavana is not considered a tefillah. It's absolutely not. And so much so, matzah data mishubashes v'libo tarot asur lo lispalo ad shetisi hashev dato. If my mind is all over the place, it's garbled, perturbed by something, it's forbidden, not just that Hashem, but it's forbidden for me to daven, because otherwise my davening hasn't done anything. Before I go on, Gloria, did you have a question?
Yes, going back a little bit, what were the two levels of kavana again?
So two levels of kavana. One is that I have to have in mind that I'm doing the mitzvah, that I'm doing something that God commanded me to do. So, for example, when I sit down to daven, you know, as long as I have, again, this is not, well, let's use Lulav as an example. So for lulav, if I pick up the lulav because I know it's Sukkot and I know I'm supposed to shake the lulav, then that's sufficient. Even if I'm not concentrating necessarily on what lulav represents, or I'm not so focused while I'm doing it, but if I understand that I'm picking it up because it's Sukkot, then that's enough. The extra level of kavana is to really understand the substance of the mitzvah. So you know, so we could talk about, you know, what lulav represents, or let's say, you know, matzah. So there might be things that matzah represents. We'll come back to that soon. But another level of kavana is not just to understand I'm eating matzah because it's the night of the Seder, but that there's a message behind it that that I'm truly internalizing what the mitzvah is about. That my heart's in the mitzvah also. Okay, so when it comes to Shema and Tefillah, if I'm paying lip service to it, it does nothing. Now the Shulchan Aruch tells us that suppose I have kavana for all the brachos, but at the very least, I'm supposed to have kavanah for avos. There's actually a Rishami that says that there are different. It talks about different rabbis who do different things while they're davening. One rabbi talks about how he was counting the bricks on the wall during davening. That just shows that this is a timeless problem. This is not just a 21st century problem with people having cell phones and being too scattered. This was always a problem that kavanah was very difficult. So much so that as long as you have kavanah for avos, you've done your job. It's a very low bar, but that's enough. And the Shulchan Aruch says that I need to have it at least for avos. If I didn't have it for avos, I should go back and daven. But the Ramah comes and says he makes it even stronger. Nowadays, ain chozrim b'shvil chisaron kavana. If I didn't have kavana while davening, I don't go back and repeat it. Not even for avos. She'ab b'chazara karv hu shelo yichavein. Because if I didn't have kavana while I said the first bracha of Shmona Esrei, and I go back and do it, it's very unlikely that I'm going to have kavana again. So in that case, why should I go back and do it again? There's absolutely no point in going back and repeating it, because when I go back and repeat it, I'm not going to have kavana either. So that just, and again, this was 500 years ago. For centuries and centuries, kavana has been a very difficult problem for tefillah, so much so that our halachists have assumed at this point that we don't have kavana. And it's absolutely crazy. So the Rav explains, Soloveitchik explains on worship of the heart. If you think that somebody who is a litvak like the Rav was just somebody, you know, who, you know, learned the mitzvos, but, you know, it was the chassidim who had meaning, not the litvaks, the Rav does not meet that standard. Kavana, as we have noted, generally requires only normative heedfulness or motivation on the part of the doer. That is to say, the intention to discharge one's duty in accord with God's will, which constitutes an integral part of the religious gesture. The controversy about mitzvah svichos kavana, whether mitzvah require intention, is confined to the class of objective norms. An objective norm would be something like doing matzah or shaking a lulav. So that's where we can talk about whether mitzvah require kavana. But as far as feel is concerned, all agree that the physical performance divorced from the inner experience is worthless. I can physically be saying the words, I can be there, I can be in shul, but if I haven't had meaning, if there's no inner experience, it's absolutely worthless. He says it's a meaningless and a stereotype ceremonial. Hence, a kavana concerning tefillah must be expressed itself not in a mere duty awareness. So for other mitzvot, duty awareness is enough. I know I'm obligated to do it, that's enough. But an all-embracing and all-penetrating transcendental experience. One turns toward God with the heart and not merely the lips, with thoughts and not only words. If kavana does not represent inward devotion or commitment, it is deprived of significance. No religious performance has occurred. That's what the Rav has to tell us about not having kavana during tefillah. It's not just enough, the first level of kavana, that I know that I'm supposed to daven and that I'm doing it, that I showed up to shul, and I know why I'm there, but I'm really thinking about five other things while I'm davening. You have not done tefillah, it is worthless. And that is harsh. And even the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah recognize that it's very hard to have kavana. And maybe we only expect it for avos. And maybe even then, you don't go back and repeat it because it's likely you're not going to have kavana. But the Rav says that aspirationally, at the very least, we haven't done anything if we haven't had kavana. But he says, nonetheless, the halacha cannot and should not put up requirements such that only a select few are able to fulfill them. And the guide, Maimonides, asserts and formulates a purpose of the religious action, complete involvement with the God experience. He preaches a moral ideal of continuous fellowship with God. Not all halachically adequate performances extend into the transforming experience of spiritual attachment. So in some ways, that brings us back a little bit to earth in terms of what the expectations are for our kavana. Now, on the one hand, maybe as far as the Shulchan Aruch is concerned, I fulfilled my obligation by saying Shmona Esrei, whether or not I have Kavanah, especially past the first bracha. And the Rav recognizes that if we said otherwise, few people would actually be able to fulfill mitzvos. It would be almost impossible. But yet, the fact that something is halakhically adequate does not mean that that's what we aspire to. It does not mean that's the transformational experience. If mitzvos are supposed to bind me closer to a Kadosh Baruch Hu, then even if by going through the motions I've done my job, I've done what I'm a good Jew, we can want and expect more out of our religious experience. We spend so much time doing mitzvos that I should want more out of that experience, and I should at least aspire to make it a transforming experience if I can. So I want to bring this back to Pesach a little bit, because it seems like most people would agree. Most poskim would agree that even if I say mitzvos require kavana, that's only so that I understand that what I'm doing is part of an obligation that I'm doing that night. So when it comes to matzah and maror, if I eat the matzah and maror, even if I'm not really actively thinking about it, I've really done my obligation. But yet, our Pesach experience could be so much more than that. The Mishnah famously tells us, it's quoted in the Haggadah, Rabban Gamliel Haya Omer, Kol Shelo Omar Shosh Advarim Elu B'Pesach, Lo Yatzar Yidei Chavasov. I did not explain these three things, I did not fulfill my obligation, that's Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. And as we go through these things, we are given the reason. Matzah, we eat because our ancestors were redeemed from Egypt, and there wasn't enough time for the dough to rise. And Maror, because the Egyptians made our experience very bitter. Now, question we can ask is, what do we not fulfill if I didn't explain Pesach, Matzah, and Maror? So it could be that I didn't do my job to explain, I didn't do my job for the Kavanah, for Magid. I didn't do my job for telling the story. But the Ramban in Milchamos explains, where he says, when we say that a person didn't fulfill their obligation, didn't explain these things, it's not they have to go back and eat them. It's just that you didn't quite do it good enough. But Ramban has a hava, meaning the Ramban has reason to believe that when Ramban Gamliel says, if I didn't do these things, I don't fulfill my obligation, that it's talking about the obligation to eat them. So what does it mean then? If I didn't explain Pesach, Matzah, and Maror, then Tosfos explains that just like the pasuk that tells us I have to talk about the Korban Pesach, what it means, Amartam Zevach Pesach, I have to explain that this is Zevach Pesach, and that's extended to Matzah and Maror. I have to explain them. So what that means then is that my eating Matzah and Maror has to be accompanied by my explaining what they're about. And if I didn't explain them, then I haven't fulfilled my obligation to eat them as much as possible. So technically, according to the letter of the law, it's enough that I ate them. I was mamale kreso, I filled my belly with them, I ate them. Halachically speaking, that should be good enough. And yet, there is still a higher level. That the higher level could be that while I'm eating them, before I eat the matzah maror, I should explain what we're about, why am I eating them? Because if I truly want to understand what I'm doing, it's not just enough to eat them, but I need to actively explain it. And that way, I'll think about it. The Mishnah famously tells us, "Behold, dor v'dor chayav adam liyot atzmo ki'ilu hu yatza mimitzrayim." In every generation, a person has to see themselves as if they left Egypt. So, what's that about? Is it that, in some ways, the way we often think about that is, I should think about what in my generation, what historical event happened that's my yitzias mitzrayim, and that's a very noble thing to do. And yet, I think it's more than that. In every generation, a person has to see themselves as if they left Egypt. It's a very difficult mitzvah. How do I see myself as if I left Egypt? Well, the whole purpose of the Seder night is to reenact Yetzias Mitzrayim. We eat the matzah because that's what our ancestors did when they left Egypt. We eat the maror because they made our lives bitter. If we want to see ourselves as if we left Egypt, we have to experience it ourselves. We have to do it. We have to reenact it, and we do that by eating matzah maror. We do it through hasiba. We do it by reclining. And if I just went through the motions, And I wasn't really thinking about it. My mind was other places. I was thinking about, maybe not this year, but what the baseball scores are and what opening day was like. And I'm thinking about Shulchan Aruch and the food. So I was at the Seder, but I wasn't really there. And I did not leave Egypt. If I want to truly have left Egypt, if I want to see myself as if I left Egypt, I need to experience a Matzah Amara for myself. In order to do that, I have to explain it. That's why Rabban Gamliel says I have to explain them. I need to understand for myself, what is this all about? So that way, while I'm eating them, I can truly appreciate where I am at the Pesach Seder, why I'm here, and what this experience is all about. So that's one level, Bechol Dor V'Dor. But the other level, Bechol Dor V'Dor, to bring this all together, that I want to talk about, to bring this back to mindfulness in the modern sense. So, of course, we're supposed to be mindful while I'm eating the matzah mara. Should be mindful for the Seder night itself. In order to have had a meaningful Seder, I should be mindful. But there's another level of leaving Egypt that's also important in this night. Dr. Kabat-Zinn explains, if mindfulness is an innate quality of mind, it is also one that can be refined through systemic practice. And for most of us, it has to be refined through practice. We've already noted how out of shape we tend to be when it comes to exercising our innate capacity to pay attention. We have such a hard time having kavana while we're saying Shmona Esrei and saying Shema, even though we're requesting for mercy, even though we're accepting Hashem. These are very important things. And yet, we're very limited in our ability to do it. But that's what the purpose of meditation is. He says that meditation is conducive to breaking free from the fetters of our own persistent blindness, self-centeredness, and delusions. If there's something that mindfulness could teach us, beyond what it means to be mindful, the fact that we left Egypt, we should be mindful during the Seder while fulfilling the mitzvos, because that in itself, as Dr. Epstein said, that itself is intrinsically valuable. That while I'm doing a mitzvah, it's intrinsically valuable for me to be present while I'm doing it. But it's also important to be mindful. But behold our door, my Yetzias Mitzrayim can also be breaking free from an inability to concentrate, to pay attention, to be present in life. And I think that's something very powerful as we think about for Pesach, that we should want to break free. We're bound. Our shibud sometimes is that it's very hard for us to be present, that we're worried about things, that we're concentrating on other things. And yet, if we can cultivate our mindfulness, then we can be Yotzei Mitzrayim as well. So how can we cultivate that mindfulness? I'll bring us back to the Shulchan Aruch. It tells us, first of all, it's supposed to have kavana while I'm davening. It's supposed to think about the Shekhinah's with me. That itself can be helpful to remind myself of what I'm doing and why I'm here. Yasir kol machshavot atrudot oto adje tishar machshavot v'kavanato zachat betvilato. That I should remove my distracting thoughts before I daven. V'kach hayu osim chasidim v'anshei ma'aseh shehem yisbodedim v'mechavenim betvilasam adje hayu magim l'hispashtus hagashmus l'hisgabrus koach ha'asichli adje magim karov l'malas nevuah. That the first, this is quoted in Mishnah Brachos, that the first, the early pious individuals, they would be mispodeda, they would be secluded, and they would essentially meditate until that they would have kavana. So in fact, while the whole world is caught up in mindfulness and meditation today, this is a very Jewish thing, that to prepare ourselves for tefillah, prepare ourselves to do a mitzvah, I want to focus myself on being present. I want to prepare myself to be there, to appreciate it before my Seder, to prepare for what I'm doing, for what its significance is, for Tfila also. And it's interesting. So what happens? You know, I'm trying to daven, I'm trying to do a mitzvah, but I have another distracting thought. What can I do? The Shulchan Aruch says that I should just wait until, I should notice it, and I should remove it from my thought. And that's really what mindfulness is. It's that remote control idea. That mindfulness is, again, the metacognition, the understanding, the realization that I'm thinking about something else, and not that I have to fight it, but I just have to recognize it, quietly try to move it to the side, and get back to what I'm trying to do. When I'm doing when I my beginning of meditation, the I was told just to breathe and to think about my breathing, and it was almost guaranteed that I was going to think about something else. But at that point, my job was just to refocus myself, to note that I was thinking about something else and refocus myself to breathing. And that's true when doing a mitzvah also, that I should notice that I'm getting distracted, but I can rechannel myself. And that's what they mean when they say mindfulness is meant to be non-judgmental, that of course we're going to get distracted, we're going to be anxious about things. That's normal. But noticing it and redirecting it is half the battle. A poem by William James. The faculty of voluntary bringing back a wandering attention over and over again is the very root of judgment, character, will. An education which should improve this faculty would be the education par excellence, but it's easier to define this ideal than to give practical instructions for bringing it about. Everyone knows that being mindful is very difficult, that having kavana is very difficult, but yet this is something that we can train ourselves to do, and that itself can be Yetzias Mitzrayim, that I can leave the Egypt of being distracted, of being scattered-brained, of not being able to be present, to appreciate the world as it is, to be aware of what's going on. Statistic apparently that 50% of our waking hours are thinking about other things. But through this training, we can bring ourselves out of Mitzrayim. I just want to end by noting that mindfulness can be very helpful to get us through the current situation. So the couple of links here, I'll share these short source sheets later so you can see some of these links. But they explain that mindfulness can help us, first of all, recognize the impulsive touching of our face. It's only now, over the past month or so, that we realize how much we touch our face. But he also said the 20 seconds of hand washing can turn to a moment of meditation, and those face-touching urges can serve as a reminder to be with a desire rather just to indulge with it. So even as we're doing things like washing our hands during this time, we can be thinking about what we're doing, that we are trying to save lives, we're trying to save our own lives, each other's lives. That's something that itself as an act of Kedusha. Mindfulness can be turning off the news, taking a break, so we're not constantly thinking about the machlo that's going around us, but that we can be here, that we can be activated, that we can be content. This here also is an interview, somebody who's an expert in mindfulness. What she does is taking a walk in nature, appreciating the beauty, talking to others, being connected. It gives me a pathway back to steadiness that's just immeasurably helpful. That this is a difficult time, that maybe we're anxious, we're not sure what to do. And yet, throughout our day, we can do things that can give us a little bit of peace of mind. Yishuv Hadas. And even while we're reading the news, shopping for groceries, we can have this idea. She says the first step for having some calm is that when we get gripped in fear is to calm our sympathetic nervous system. A simple way to do this with long, deep breaths. Take at least 3 full breaths, counting to 5 with the inhale and counting to 5 with the exhale. And with the exhale, intentionally release tension. This begins to calm down the nervous system. So mindfulness, to summarize, can be valuable for so many things. First of all, during this time, mindfulness can help us to remain reasonably calm. We obviously need to be alert, but we also don't want to be totally subjugated and prisoners to the fear, but we want to be able to live in emotional soundness. Mindfulness can be helpful for that. As we said at the beginning, mindfulness can be so essential to our physical and emotional health. But when it comes to Yiddishkeit also, mindfulness is so important because the mitzvahs that we do require mindfulness. If we want to have a connection with Ribono Shel Olam, then we need to be mindful. We need to be able to have kavana. Whether or not mitzvahs technically require kavana, that doesn't matter so much. But our aspiration is that if we want to truly appreciate what it means to celebrate a Yom Tov, to do a mitzvah, even to do a chesed, even doing a chesed, our spiritual lives are so much richer when we're aware of what we're doing, the magnitude of what we're doing, and what its good is. I'll end with Dr. Epstein. God says, remember, each mitzvah is a reminder. Don't forget. Forgetfulness is that point where a man is most tempted to say, of my own power that brought this about. We're Jewish people because God saved us, not because of anything that's inherently great about us. And here is where God gives us his advice, precisely at the moment when a person can be drawn away. That advice, that mitzvah, is meant to bring a person back. Do not forget, do not get pulled away. And that's exactly what Matzah Maror, what Pesach is about. Almost all the mitzvahs we do are Zecher L'Tziyas Mitzrayim. And here, as we're sitting down to the Seder night, as we perform the mitzvah, it's a reminder for us to not forget Hashem, to have Hashem present in our lives, that Hashem performs miracles for us, that Hashem is our Redeemer. And may this be a Chodesh of Geula from this virus, that we should be with Mashiach, Lashana Bab Yerushalayim, not just in Yerushalayim itself, but with everybody else, with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. I wish everybody a Chag Kasher and Sameach.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you,
Rabbi. I will end.
Could you have a bibliography of, you know, the books that you quoted from?
Yes, I'm gonna